fasten your seatbelts, and turn up your radio. We're jumping to light speed. Stand by.
All systems stable. Stand by.
Ray Bradbury once said, "In science fiction, we dream." For many of us, fans and creators alike, we've been dreaming a long, long time. Welcome to Route 51 and our annual trek into the final frontier. I'm Rick Ryer, in for Shireen Seewert, and along for the ride today is our resident navigator, historian, and New York Times bestselling author, John Jackson Miller. John's latest novel, Star Trek Discovery, Die Standing, weaves a tale of deceit, treachery, and loyalties. For many, Star Trek is something we grew up with, yet the Trek universe continues to expand, creating fans across the board and bringing us older Terrans along, boldly going where no one has gone before. At the same time, Star Wars: The Empire Strikes Back is celebrating 40 years since its release. John has several acclaimed Star Wars novels under his belt, including Star Wars: A New Dawn and Star Wars Kenobi. His latest work is a short story in the anthology The Empire Strikes Back from a Certain Point of View. Today on Route 51, we welcome John back to discuss his work in the worlds of both franchises, as well as the comic and graphic novel industry. You can call in with your questions as well at 800-780-9742 or email us at wpr.org. John Jackson Miller, welcome back to Route 51.
Hey, Rick, glad to be here.
That's great to have you here. You know, John, I must right off the bat say that Die Standing has kept me on the edge of my seat. Well done. Well done. Tell us about the storyline and when it happens within the Star Trek Discovery timeline without revealing too much.
Okay, so Star Trek Discovery takes place, the first and second seasons, I won't spoil any more than that, but the first and second seasons take place about a decade before Captain Kirk is on the Enterprise. So this is in a period where we've just had the war with the Klingons. It's still sort of original series time frame, but everything looks a little fancier than it does later on because, of course, we have modern special effects. And so everybody just has to get used to that cognitive dissonance of, us being able to do holograms and other things that they couldn't do in television in 1966. The Mirror Universe is something which comes up in an episode of the original series where in a transporter accident, and just about every interesting thing that happens in Star Trek has something to do with a transporter accident somewhere, or the holodeck going crazy, or something technological just going its own way. There's another alternate reality where everybody is just a nasty person. It is never really fully described or explained. What the historical moment was that turned everybody in the Terran Empire the way they were. That's their word for the Federation. There have been multiple series that have hopped in and out of this universe. Deep Space Nine did some crossover episodes with it. Enterprise, the Scott Bakula series, did as well. And they also showed us a moment of Terran history. It was not the pivot moment where everything changed, despite everyone's belief. But what they did is they showed us the moment where the first contact from the movie First Contact happened. Zefram Cochran is not the good, happy, drunken sailor that we see in that movie. He's actually dastardly and carries a gun. So this is kind of how it is. There are equivalents for just about every character in our universe, in their universe. And what brings this into conjunction with Discovery and what we call the Prime Universe is that there's a crossover sequence in the first season of Discovery, which is really good, where we discover that Philippa Georgiou, the mentor, the recently departed mentor of Michael Burnham, the main character, exists in the Mirror Universe. Not only exists, but she rules it. She is the Emperor Georgiou, and she has a list of titles an arm long, and she is very much not a nice person. And so naturally, in what I consider to be a brilliant move, I loved it when I saw it, when things go wrong over there, she leaps into our universe, and that brings her to my attention.
Well, and speaking of that, you know, she's a character obviously you did not create, but you're tasked with taking that creation, that character, through this novel that you wrote. And how do you get into a character's head of somebody that you haven't created, but you need to take that a little further?
Well, I have to do that in any tie-in work I do, whether it's Star Wars or Star Trek or Battlestar Galactica. I simply, you know what the character has gone through. I see what the character has done. I, you know, try and get a sense of their speech patterns and, you know, if there's a TV version or a movie version. And then I just sort of kind of, you know, take a whole thought experiment. You know, what if you were this person? What would this person be thinking right now? And as it happens, Emperor Georgiou has a lot of opinions about the Starfleet Star Trek universe. You know, she would naturally see it as a very mealy-mouthed, weak place where she would be able to take over on her own in short order if only she had the right opportunity and found the right weapon.
Well, another element that you bring back in Die Standing, and it's not really a well-known piece of Star Trek history, if you will, is Section 31. It's an autonomous department originally sanctioned in the Starfleet Charter to take any and all measures to dispatch threats to the Federation. Now, what we're seeing is Section 31 has actually gone rogue. Tell us about the people. Tell us about Section 31. Who are they, and how do they fit within your storyline?
Well, Section 31 is sort of the black ops part of Starfleet. Its origins are in the Deep Space Nine series, in all the intrigue that we got with that. But it has been around for a very long time. And the reason that it connected to what I was doing is that in between season one and season two of Discovery, when, you know, the Emperor is in our universe sort of as a free agent, she is recruited by the head of Section 31, a gentleman named Leland, no first name, who tries to get her to be one of their spies. He thinks, well, you know, we're the people who do the things that other people won't. Well, she's the person who does things that other people wouldn't dream of, and tries to bring her into the fold. The thing is that Emperor Georgiou is not a joiner. She has no real intention. She has no real intention of working with Starfleet or the Federation, except to her own ends. That is kind of what this book Die Standing is about. It's her going through the stages, really, of having lost more than anybody has ever had anywhere, because she was the Emperor of the entire known universe, and now she's expected to just sign on and do somebody else's bidding.
Now, philosophically now, I guess there is some sort of debate, and sometimes heated debate, about whether Section 31 betrays the values of Gene Roddenberry that he created in the Star Trek society. How do you feel about that?
Well, of course it does.
Indeed.
Well, of course it does. You know, remember, Gene Roddenberry is writing in the 1960s. You know, he's writing you know, what he's hoping will be a utopian society. You know, a lot of the drama has to come from conflict. And we do have other kinds of stories being told in the Star Trek universe, particularly where Section 31 comes from. Is Deep Space Nine, which is a series that gets into lots and lots of shades of gray. You know, it does make sense that someplace like this would probably exist. You know, what's fun about it is I'm able to pair Georgiou up with a couple of characters, including one of the Dax characters from Deep Space Nine, an earlier incarnation. K characters who are very much sort of a break on her, her worst instincts, who do represent much more of a Roddenberry-ish view of the world. And so we do get that kind of tug of war in this book. The book is very much aware of what is wrong about the Mirror Universe.
Now, John, you've been with us on Route 51. This is maybe your sixth appearance, maybe the seventh. It's been a long time every year, and we really love having you here. But this is the first time we've asked you to actually come up with your top five favorite Star Trek moments. Here's number five.
Ship's log, Mr. Spock reporting. Dr. McCoy and I are prisoners of the chief criminal boss of a society patterned after old Earth gangsters.
Put your hands over your head, or you ain't gonna have no head to put your hands over.
You wanna live, don't you, Kirk? You bet you do. But after I get through with you...
I don't have those tools by then. I'm gonna call up your ship and have them pick you up. In a box.
I will tell you, John, that this is probably one of my very favorite original series episodes. Why is it in your top five?
The fun thing about this episode is it's steeped in sort of the production history of Star Trek. Star Trek was, of course, owned by Desilu, which was the studio created by Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball. It was filmed on the same location as another previous Desilu series, The Untouchables. So this was a chance to actually get a use out of all of the props and costumes from that. And it's just a wonderfully silly episode that shows how malleable the concept can be of Star Trek, being able to cross over with this planet that is full of people who talk like 1920s gangsters. And then the thing of personal importance with it is I was born the night that this episode, A Piece of the Action, first aired. So that's my connection.
That's incredible. Here's number four.
If you allow him to live, I will give you something that will serve your purpose far more than my death. I will accept discommodation. You would do this in open council. It would be the same as admitting your father's guilt, Worf. So be it.
What about that, John?
All right, this is from the Next Generation episode, Sins of the Father, and this is when Worf decides to take the blame for something that his father actually didn't do. It dishonors him in order to save the Klingon Empire from collapse and crisis. And this really marked for me as a viewer watching this series for the first time the blossoming of the Klingons and their culture from just being the random bad guys to a much deeper and more interesting world. And I ended up writing a trilogy of novels called Prey, which basically, tangle with some of the issues that are in this series, including Worf's discommodation.
Now, going back to Mr. Spock, your third top in your top five Star Trek moments has to deal with the episode called A Mock Time.
After a time, you may find that having is not so pleasing a thing, after all, as wanting. It is not logical, but it is often true.
Interesting statement. Take us there.
All right. A Mock Time is really sort of the Sins of the Father episode for the original series when it comes to the Vulcans. It gives us we set foot on the world, we find out all about it, and we also find that Spock is having a similar sort of situation here where he's having to make a decision it's something that's very personal. It's very emotional. And of course, the end of the episode has a wonderful moment with McCoy where he realizes that Spock has acted emotionally. But it's one of the many moments that really crosses over great world building in Star Trek with emotional importance.
Now, in the Next Generation, one of the arch emesis of the Enterprise happened to be the Borg, and this is where your number two comes from.
Our weapon is useless.
We'll sabotage them again if we have to.
We can't maintain power. We don't have the time. Prepare to fire.
At least consult with Starfleet Command. Get Admiral Hanson on subspace.
Belay that order, Lieutenant. There's no time.
Sir, we are being hailed by the Borg.
On screen.
Of Borg. Resistance is futile. Your life as it has been is over. From this time forward, you will service us.
Mr. Worf.
And, of course, that's the cliffhanger at the end of the season. And I do remember that quite vividly.
Again, this is best of both worlds. This is a moment where you know, it is there's an expression, grows the beard, is the opposite of jumping the shark. Star Trek gets good when Riker grows the beard. And this is Will Riker, one of my favorite characters in Star Trek, having to do the unthinkable and having to decide we're going to have to fire on Captain Picard, who has been taken by the Borg, has been compromised. This really is, I think, for most fans, the moment where you know, Star Trek: The Next Generation basically goes immortal, and it sets up a lot of stuff that's going to, you know, follow us for the rest of the series.
And briefly, John, take us to your number one Star Trek moment.
Okay, this is the flip side of that, in fact, where here we had Riker willing to sacrifice a friend to save the galaxy. Here we have the opposite.
Fighting chance to live.
And briefly, John, why is that your number one?
This is from Star Trek III, the Search for Spock. Really my favorite of the Star Trek movies, because it's where the Enterprise is sacrificed by Captain Kirk in order to save Spock. This is really the inverse of what we just saw there. This is where we realize that this show is about a family. It's not just about the world that they built. It's not just about the Starfleet. It's not just about the Federation. They're willing to sacrifice.
You're listening to Central Wisconsin writer John Jackson Miller as we delve into the worlds of Star Trek and Star Wars. When we return, we'll talk about the 40th anniversary of The Empire Strikes Back. And you can call us at 800-780-9742. We're back on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer, New York Times bestselling author and Central Wisconsinite. John Jackson Miller is with us as we discuss Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, and other tales from a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. We've got your questions, too, at 800-780-9742, or you can email us at route51@wpr.org. John, I'm really feeling old today, celebrating the 40th anniversary of the release of The Empire Strikes Back. I can still remember, after much anticipation, seeing the film on opening night. And while Star Trek has many endearing qualities and characters, and I've been a huge fan for a long, long time, Star Wars seems to evoke different and deeper emotions. From your perspective, how has the Star Wars story touched so many on a much deeper level?
Well, I'll tell you, Star Wars versus Star Trek has been the place where many, many convention debates have been born. So it's not something that either side takes lightly. I have to say that I certainly, obviously, enjoy both on different levels. Star Trek is technological. Star Wars is being a space opera, being a fantasy in many regards, being a story about a family right at the beginning. It's something that you could kind of go down to the personal level a bit easier. We don't really see the lives of a lot of people who live on the ground doing mundane things in Star Trek. The first person we meet in Star Wars is Luke Skywalker running around on Tatooine, living, he believes, as far as he could possibly be from anything important. The bright, shining center of the galaxy. And of course, he turns out to be the center of things. And, that makes it, mythical on a level that only really, Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and several other shows like that can be.
Well, you and 39 of your colleagues contributed to The Empire Strikes Back from a certain point of view. It's an anthology celebrating the 40th anniversary of the film. Tell us about the project as a whole.
We did the first one of these with Random House Del Rey 3 years ago for A New Hope. The idea was we wanted to tell 40 stories from 40 different authors, each taking a different moment or side character or main character from the movie and telling what was going on for them at a specific moment during that picture. My first one I did, in the Star Wars A New Hope one, I did a character from my Kenobi novel, one of the Tusken Raiders, one of the Sand People. And so when it came time to do something for Empire Strikes Back, it made perfect sense that I would pick the character Rey Sloane, an Imperial officer, because the Empire Strikes Back is kind of a meat grinder. It kills a lot of Imperial officers, and it's not the Rebellion that's doing the killing. It's Darth Vader.
Now, the character, Rey Sloane, you first introduced in A New Dawn. That was a character you recreated. And she's been appearing in all kinds of other books and comics as well. Tell us about Rey, where she came from, and how she fits within this story without, again, revealing too much.
Rey Sloane is an Imperial captain, and she's somebody who's trying to make her way through the Empire without, getting killed unnecessarily by Darth Vader. But also one of the interesting things about her is she's not evil. It occurred to me that there had to be, this machine that the Emperor had taken control of. There had to be a lot of people that believed in the aims, but who were not really aware of how evil the Emperor was, who were, not really, accomplices on the same level as everybody else. And so she is a character who we kind of show her journey at different points from cadet to captain to later on in her later appearances in other books and the video game Star Wars Squadrons, where we kind of see everything through her eyes. I created this character and I talked to Lucasfilm after she first appeared. And I said, this is our character that we really ought to follow through multiple different things, because I think she can sort of be our tour guide.
And she is cunning. She's a very cunning character. And you've also said in some of your writings that canny operators like Lando Calrissian, which we'll hear from later, are some of your favorite kinds of characters to write. What is it about these kinds of characters that makes them your favorites?
Well, I mean, particularly in Star Wars, everything is in black and white, including the costumes.
Sure.
There have to be a lot of people that are sort of navigating in between. Han Solo, we love right at the beginning because he shoots first. And then, of course, then he doesn't. But that's not my place to say. I think everybody likes reading smart characters. People like reading smart villains. And certainly in the Die Standing novel, I had a smart villain who was the main character. So it's right. been a lot of fun.
Now, how has writing for Star Wars changed since Disney acquired the rights to the franchise? And has it changed? Or if so, how?
Well, there is what we call the Lucasfilm Story Group. The New Dawn novel, which was where Roy Sloan first appeared, was the first novel that was written in conjunction with them. And the story group coordinates everything that's coming out from these other TV series that are coming out with the movies, with the comics and everything. So they're kind of an air traffic control. It's basically one more level, both, helping us not collide with things, but also helping to inspire ideas of things that will be on screen. There is, to that degree, some of that in Star Trek now as well. I worked with one of the Discovery writers on the concept for the last two novels I did. And in fact, some of the stuff that is in that novel is in the Mirror Universe storyline, which just started yesterday on Discovery.
One of the questions I really was intrigued about asking you is, how do you prepare before you sit down to write, whether it's Star Trek or Star Wars or any of your other projects, how do you mentally prepare yourself to write these things before you actually come up with the first draft?
I do a lot of research. I watch all the episodes. I try to get myself in the mind frame of the film and the mind frame of the characters. And then I also take a look at all of the other supporting material that's out there. There are two sites, Wikipedia for Star Wars and Memory Alpha for Star Trek. Memory Beta is for the Star Trek novels. There's even one for Battlestar Galactica. Every show in the world has it, where the fans have indexed things that even the creators of the shows have forgotten. Those things all help me out.
Have you found anything really surprising in your research?
Always. I mean, I'm looking at things all the time. We just found out that the Indiana Jones, the fifth movie, is coming out. And of course I wrote the adaptation to the fourth Indiana Jones movie for Dark Horse Comics. And I was looking up and seeing when Indiana Jones was born, because obviously that was going to be something that would, if anybody writes about him, that will come up. Of course, he was born in 1899, which puts anything that he does, if he's going to be Harrison Ford's age, it'll be during Watergate. So.
Now, I understand there's some great news that just came out recently about the Knights of the Old Republic. Tell us about what's coming up. What
Knights of the Old Republic is a comic series that I did for about 5 years back in the 2000s. And it's a 1,284-page story that kind of crosses Star Wars with The Fugitive. It is about a young Jedi student who is not good at anything, but he does get accused of a crime he didn't commit. And he has to go about clearing his name. Marvel is publishing all the Star Wars comics now. These comics have been reprinted in first they were reprinted in 10 small volumes, then 3 big volumes. Now in July, we're getting a Marvel Omnibus, which is a 1,350-page doorstop of a book. It's in hardcover. It's oversized, so the art's going to look beautiful. It's not for the casual collector. I mean, it's $125. So definitely people want to pre-order that at their comics retailers as soon as they can to make sure they get them, because this is going to be the ultimate collection for this particular book.
Well, congratulations on that. That sounds really exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing it. Like Star Trek, and the Star Wars universe has really a massive cast of characters and worlds to explore. If I wanted to introduce somebody to the world beyond the books and movies and so on, where would you recommend I start?
There's a bunch of different places to start with. I mean, the New Dawn novel and the Rebels TV series, which it is a prequel of, that is a jumping on point for somebody who wants to find out about the Rebellion era. Leading up to what we see in Rogue One, leading up to what we see in Star Wars, and then they can go from there. Obviously, there are other jumping on points that were designed. I mean, the Phantom Menace prequel to that is going to be is going to be a number of other stories. They have a new milieu that they brought out just now called the High Republic, which is just now starting in January with novels and comics. These all take place before Phantom Menace. And of course, then that leads you into Clone Wars and everything else from there. There's just a whole lot of different on-ramps where you can get into Star Wars, and they're making more every day.
We were talking with John Jackson Miller, New York Times best-selling author and a Central Wisconsinite. If you'd like to ask him a question, you can certainly call at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742. You can also email us at route51@wpr.org. Last year, John, you were we were talking about, when you were with us, The Rise of Skywalker, the last film that came out. Now, Disney has really gone beyond and really is pushing.
Say the least.
Yeah, exactly, and creating such incredible work. The Mandalorian is in its second season. It was released not too long ago. And you just posted an announcement yesterday on Twitter about Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yes, that's an upcoming series with both our Ewan McGregor from the prequel trilogy as Obi-Wan Kenobi, and now they say it'll be Hayden Christensen in there too, reprising the role of Darth Vader some way in some shape or form. I'm really delighted that the series is called Obi-Wan Kenobi, because nobody will confuse it now with my novel Star Wars Kenobi. That does happen sometimes. There was a novel called the Star Wars The Last Jedi that came out the same year that Kenobi did. And of course, we got a movie called Star Wars The Last Jedi just a few years ago. Those were two of many different things that are being done by Disney Plus, the streaming service. And particularly with the situation in movie theaters in 2020, it makes sense to have a whole lot of more stuff coming out through the streaming service. And there are just a whole bunch of things coming out. There's a series that is kind of a sequel, or it's what follows those High Republic stories I was talking about. They're doing something for Lando Calrissian. They're doing just a whole lot of different stories. It really does, bring it into a place that's kind of similar to where Star Trek has been for the previous two or three years. Star Trek had a bit of a running start because they already had a streaming service in CBS All Access, which is soon to become Paramount Plus, just so that we make sure that there's no mistake that it's the same sort of thing with Disney Plus. And there's this big world of stories that they can tap. And of course, Star Wars also, being from Disney, there's also lots of Marvel shows that were announced at the same time. So there's plenty of stuff out there.
Now, like we did in our last segment, we did ask John about his top five Star Wars moments. Here's number five.
You want to buy some death sticks?
You don't want to sell me death sticks.
I don't want to sell you death sticks.
You want to go home and rethink your life.
I want to go home and rethink my life.
Every time I hear that or see that, I just can't stop laughing. It's hilarious.
That is the best line from any of the prequels. That is Obi-Wan Kenobi talking with a random person in a bar in Attack of the Clones. And that stood out more than anything from that entire Clone Wars era for me. That little exchange done as a joke, because it said to me something that the Jedi probably do every day. They're this free, police force that runs around fighting for the Republic. And sometimes they're a bad deal for the Republic because occasionally they go nuts and take over. But it struck me that the Jedi have to have quieter duties. They have to, be ministers in a sense. They have to sort of be circuit riders going around randomly helping people and in small crises, not just the large ones. And that was something that when I did my my Kenobi novel in 2013, which is still available in audiobook and paperback and ebook, I wanted to follow up on, because the character is not able to do anything big for the galaxy while sitting on Tatooine. He can only do these little things.
And that's one of the things that I really really enjoy about Star Wars is the humor that is weaved into these tales, just like that. And this one is a little bit of a different kind of humor.
Lord Vader, what about Leia and the Wookiee?
They must never again leave this city.
That was never a condition of our agreement, nor was giving hand to this bounty hunter.
Perhaps you think you're being treated unfairly?
No.
Good. It would be unfortunate if I had to leave the garrison here.
This deal is getting worse all the time.
What about that, John?
Lando Calrissian, my favorite character from the original trilogy, in part because, going back to what we said on Star Trek with regard to Section 31 and Emperor Georgiou, he's a character that has to exist in two worlds. He has to live there. He's like Ray Sloan. He has to negotiate between, these immovable objects that are out there in the galaxy, these things that are going on much bigger than he is. And yet he's smart. He's canny. He's a hustler. He can figure out how to make his way and eventually do the right thing. And that's why, he's the kind of hero that we did not get, even really in Han Solo, because Han Solo, the ice cracks pretty quickly. We're never quite sure which way Lando is going to go. But he does the right thing.
And here's your third favorite Star Wars moment.
For over 1,000 generations, the Jedi Knights were the guardians of peace and justice in the Old Republic. Before the Dark Times. Before the Empire.
Well, right there, that's 2-3 lines from Sir Alec Guinness, birthing a whole 150 some odd novels and graphic novels and stories beyond the 1,000 generations. All of that was just left open for everybody in the expanded universe, and now in the more the other tie-ins that we've been doing to try to fill in the gaps of that. And I always love it when there's anything that's that Sir Gush's open-ended invitation to explore.
And from Obi-Wan Kenobi, we go to the other philosopher in the ways of the Force.
Its energy surrounds us and binds us. Luminous beings, though, not this crude matter. You must feel the Force around you. Here, between you, me, the tree, the rock, everywhere. Yes, even between the land and the ship.
It seems that Yoda was one of those that tied all three of the original trilogy together, John.
Yeah, this is, again, where Star Wars leaps into the mythological. This is no longer a science fiction show. This is, my father, who is not really big into science fiction or anything else, told me once, this movie series, these are probably not even humans. They're probably other kinds of characters we don't even know. And this was Yoda kind of speaking to that. Luminous beings are we. What's going on here is part of a much bigger conflict on many different levels. And, Luke is a small part of it, and we get to see a part of it.
And John Jackson Miller's favorite moment from Star Wars is this.
Now, young Skywalker, you will die.
My favorite moment during Star Wars as a viewer. When I saw this film first day front and center with a whole bunch of kids, the matinee, at this sequence, the climactic sequence, spoiler warning from Return of the Jedi, everybody in the theater stood up. I had never seen that before. It was like a sporting event. And when Darth Vader makes the correct choice, kids have already been cheering him to do so for about 5 seconds, 10 seconds, and then the place just completely erupts. It goes berserk, and it sort of puts a bow on the whole story. And again, it was just an experience like I have never had. Also, the end of Star Wars in 1977 the same way, but you know, this was the first time anybody had seen this, and wow, was it crazy.
And it was in the theater that I was in as well. Thank you so much for that recollection. Central Wisconsin and New York Times best-selling author John Jackson Miller is our guest on Route 51. When we return, we'll take a look into the comics and graphic novel industry and the effect COVID-19 has had on it and science fiction conventions. You can join the conversation, too, by calling 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742. I'm Rick Ryer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer with John Jackson Miller, New York Times best-selling author and owner of Far Too Many Comic Books. If you have a question or comment for John, you can call us at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742. Or you can send us an email at route51@wpr.org. John, you're the founder of Comicron, the world's largest public database for comic book sales and figures. Tell us about how Comicron started and what people can find out there.
Well, what brought me to Wisconsin was I was hired as the editor of Comics Retailer Magazine in the early 90s, the trade magazine for all the comic shops. And after I started writing comics and novels full time, I continued to, on the side, keep this database that I had been tracking of what comics sold. And I started going back into history as well, back to the 60s, back even to the 30s, to track what was going on. And so, you know, I have been working both backwards and forwards. You know, probably later today, I'll be posting the numbers for October 2020 estimates. And, these always give me a picture of what things are like. And, you know, I can kind of compare that with where comics were across time. And, of course, the story for comics turns out to be a lot better than people think it is. It's over $1 billion business. It goes beyond the comic shops into the chain bookstores and also digital these days.
What's trending right now?
Well, you know, one of the things that's been going on is in the book channel, in the bookstores, there are young adult graphic novels that are they don't appear as comic books first, but they appear as graphic novels, like Dog Man is one that just sells in the millions, and it's selling everywhere, places like Walmart. These are places that, have not had comics of any kind in years. Because they got rid of the spinner racks, they got rid of the 32-page comics, but they are able to sell these done-in-one kind of stories in these smaller formats. So this has added a leg under the table. The major part of the business is still in the comic shops. More than half of the just about half of the volume of the business is still coming through the direct market, as we call it, the comic shop market. And of course, that's weathered some turns here during COVID, but seems to be in a lot better shape than anybody, including myself, would have imagined it would be at this point.
Well, looking at the Comic Run site, you cite in October. I'm just looking back at October of this year, $37 million in sales of comic books. Is that correct?
Well, and that's just for the publishers besides DC Comics.
Right.
One of the crazy things that happened this year is, during the pandemic, when the distributor for comics was forced to shut down for a few weeks, DC went off on its own and created its own distributors. So one of my challenges has been trying to pull all this information back together and project things. It is something where we have seen a lot of the money that had been going to conventions is going into comic shops. And comic shops are doing sales online over eBay. eBay has just exploded. The aftermarket has just exploded. And this is part of the strength of comics. We're magazines, but we're the magazines that people keep. We're the magazines that people don't throw away. And, nobody is going to pay, hundreds of dollars for a Time magazine that came out, 10 years ago. But if it's the first issue of The Walking Dead, they might think about it.
Well, specifically, what is driving sales right now?
Well, I think that is part of it. There was this reduction of material that was available for a while, during the slowdown. We had gone since 1935, basically, there hadn't been a month, there hadn't been a week without any comic books. And in April, there were only three that came out. And it has just taken a while to get ramped back up. The publishers have been very helpful. Image Comics, Boom Comics, made everything for retailers returnable. Other publishers like Marvel put out really good discounts for retailers, and Diamond Comic Distributors has done a lot to try to help the retailers keep going, keep money going through the door. And it really helps also that these stores don't just sell comics; they also sell toys, they also sell action figures, and of course the graphic novels. Those never really stopped coming out because, that's part of this larger book industry, the bound editions. And same for the digital comics, those continue to flow. So, comics have been around, 80 plus years at this point. They're not going away. And I don't know what the numbers for 2020 will look like in the periodical market. They do look like they will be up for the graphic novel market, and that is an amazing thing to be able to say, considering the number of stores that have been closed, that had to close to customers coming inside this past year.
Well, what are the top three comics that are selling right now?
Batman has just been huge for DC Comics. There's another arc that they've been doing called Death Metal that has been big for them. Marvel is just doing really excellent work with sales with Venom and Thor, and the Amazing Spider-Man just had two anniversary issues in a row, so that was kind of big for October. Over at Image Comics, Spawn has had a real revival because Todd McFarlane, the creator, has come back to it. And then there are a lot of smaller titles from those other publishers. Just about everybody has something with a TV series attached now. So, The Boys is a series from Dynamite. That's on I think on Netflix. Umbrella Academy is from Dark Horse. That's on Netflix. And there's just so many other series out there that are everything seems to come with a TV or movie deal these days.
Well, growing up, Batman you mentioned and Green Lantern were my go-to comics as a kid. What were yours?
Well, Star Wars, of course, obviously. I was big on Spider-Man. I was really big on a science fiction series by Jim Starlin, the creator of the Thanos character for Avengers. He did a science fiction series called Dreadstar. I loved Dreadstar, and one of the things I tried to do with my own comics is recapture the feel that those comics gave me when I was reading them.
You know, John, we started the show with an uplifting quote from Ray Bradbury, celebrating science fiction with our dreams for the future. That's the kind of hope it seems that we need right now with this time. But he also said the function of science fiction is not only to predict the future, but to prevent it. What do you think is the most powerful thing about writing science fiction?
I think that it allows us to have conversations about a lot of things in the world at a remove, at a safe remove where we don't have to be arguing about it on Twitter. We can talk about it in the time frame of a different place using different characters.
Thanks, John. Great having you on the show today. This has been Route 51. We'll see you next week.